VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we'll be discussing that Boer draw at Anfield, another thriller for Villa, and Arsenal moving back to the top of the Premier League Christmas tree. We'll also be talking about West Ham and matters at the bottom of the table, and joining me, Tom Clark. We've got two of the finest football writers around, Tom Allnut and Hamza Khalik Lunat, and our second favourite footballer-turned-pundit after Tony Cascarino, Gregor Robertson, is here as well. Come on, just a little jibe. Tony's not here. I'd say the same to him. Now, Hamza, it's your debut on the show this season. Welcome to the Game Podcast. Slightly worrying from my point of view, given that I like to like make little jibes at Gregor Robertson. You said beforehand that you're probably just going to agree with everything Gregor says. Anything else you're going to be offering the listeners as well as agreeing with Gregor?
Not really, no. Gregor does a really good job and I'm just standing in for Alisson today, I guess. Okay, fine. So, if anything Alisson has missed out, I'll cover me.
Some very literary, ethereal views on football that kind of zigzag off and then come back to the eventual point. I'd say that's Alisson's kind of bread and butter. So if you can deliver that for us, that would be great. One thing you can deliver for us, of course, is being a Liverpool fan. So you do stand in for Alisson on that front. And let's go to Anfield and their 0-0 draw with Manchester United. I mean, I don't really know what to make of this match, and I don't want to dwell on it too long because it was not the kind of classic, thrilling 7-0 that people perhaps were expecting. Starting perhaps with Manchester United then, Henry Winter writing this morning on the Times website about this showing that the players are behind Erik ten Hag. And let's be honest, it is a positive result for them with the players that they had at their disposal to get and draw at Anfield, despite it being a kind of quite a negative, pragmatic performance, Greg.
Yeah, everyone expected them to get rolled over, basically. I think, by the looks of it, Liverpool expected that was going to be the case as well. So, I don't know, I think you can draw a little bit too much out of it. This is the story of Manchester United, really, for a number of years now, and that the cycle of kind of woeful performances and then some more spirited ones that show they're not completely throwing the towel in. But I think over a longer period of time, that's consistency that's been elusive, and that's what Ten Hag said after the game. He said we need to have a sort of minimum level of standards that we reach every game, and that's been our problem. And they reached them in this game, but beyond that, they didn't do that much. And I think it still showed that Manchester United are a long way from competing with the best teams in the country.
We discussed last week on Thursday's show when we had Wally Downs in about kind of an idea of Manchester United going a little bit, not back to basics, but just kind of stripping away all the kind of outside thought about styles of play and actually just working really, really hard. We did at least see that, Tom, didn't we? And I wonder whether perhaps in a team that's kind of really struggled sometimes with these kind of overblown superstars not performing, when you've got a midfield of Manu, Amrabat, Scott McTominay, actually that buys into that idea that you are at least going to get three players who are going to work for the manager.
Yeah, back to basics, I guess, and Varane in defence, you know, who knows? He's actually a very good defender and has made a bit of a difference. I mean, I guess, you know, there's a danger, I think, with United, obviously, week to week, kind of lurching from one narrative to the next, you know, that this is the crisis, Ten Hag's about to leave, and then a match like this, and you think, well, everything's fine. But actually, maybe it's just kind of consistent with what we know about United, that probably in the league right now, they're maybe the sort of sixth, seventh, eighth best team. I mean, you look at the results they've had recently, they've kind of scraped past Burnley, Sheffield United, Fulham, Luton. You know, okay, they've got a decent goalless draw away at Liverpool, but that can happen if you're kind of in the top half of the league. I think this is fairly consistent with where we think United are at. You know, they're not going to be challenging the top two or three. they may put a run together to sort of, you know, challenge for the top four or five. But, you know, this result, I guess you could say, was a bit of a rally. But equally, I mean, I don't think there was anything there creatively in this performance that makes you think they're suddenly going to go on a run and you know, this side is suddenly going to become a team that's anything different to what we've seen this season. I agree with you. Back to kind of basics, maybe the fundamentals were there and maybe that's encouraging. But if anything, you know, it just kind of shows how low the bar is nowadays. You know, if you have sort of a performance that's just sort of determined and fighting and defensively fairly organised, then you can count that as a positive for United. You know, they didn't get thrashed ultimately Liverpool, and that is kind of the best you can say about them.
Yeah, one of those players I mentioned there, Hamza, Kobbie Mainoo, should United fans be, they were excited about him in the summer when he was part of their kind of pre-season plans and then he got injured. Is he a kind of player that could be a bright spark for them going forward?
Yeah, he's quite a good young player. I think the key with all young players, though, is not place too much expectation on them. He seems quite promising, but again, like, just temper those expectations. He had that really nice pass that he played in behind to Garnacho, which almost resulted in a shot, but I think Trent Alexander-Arnold just got the touch in before. That was a nice move. He shows an ability to receive in space, play through pressure, so good qualities that you'd hope from a team that's looking to dominate possession and play through the lines. But again, just a very young player, so it's important to not sort of over-egg him just to make sure that he doesn't sort of feel the weight of expectation.
Telling me not to get carried away, you're definitely from the Gregor Robertson school of punditry. But moving on to Liverpool, Hamza, I wanted to ask you about them. Paul Joyce has written on the Times website today, all too frenzied and forced as 34 Liverpool shots come to nothing. Would you agree with that frenzied and forced nature, do you think? Or is it a little bit of what Gregor said of where they were expecting United to be really poor and they were expecting to kind of beat them and maybe they got wrapped up in the idea of, oh, it's going to be 7-0 again?
I think Paul's actually spot on, as he usually is. The way that Liverpool started, there was a sort of frenzied nature to that. You saw that they pressed super, super hard, and I think it came across like they wanted it a bit too much. They wanted to really stamp their authority on the match, and they started taking shots from silly areas. They got the ball into generally good areas, moved it into final third, then started to move into the box, but from there it was really bad decision making. Liverpool played too narrow, Trent Alexander-Arnold came in field, which is fine, does it normally, but when he did that there weren't enough options out wide on the right to hold the width, and Anfield is quite a narrow pitch anyway. It has one of its smallest sort of square meterages in the league, so maximising space is quite important, and Liverpool didn't quite do that. And yeah, there are a lot of shots from outside the box, really forced efforts. Yeah, this was the thing is, so I guess 34 shots, 8 shots on target, 2.3 XG. You'd expect sometimes that maybe one of those would just bounce in off someone. Sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. But yeah, just really poor decision making in the final third from Liverpool.
I mean, in fairness, Liverpool had a 100% home record before this game, so like often with comprehensive wins, looking at their 3-0 against Brentford, Forest 3-0 as well, 3-1 against West Ham, 3-0 against Aston Villa. They kind of found a way to win against Fulham most recently as well. So despite everything we're saying about Manchester United, it was like a pretty good defensive display in that they shut space and they looked like, as Tom's saying, with Varane back in the team, Shaw back in the team, even with Johnny Evans playing, who's kind of, you know, he knows what he's doing if you're defending the box. They looked like they had a, you know, kind of fairly solid back line. They did ride their luck a little bit, but for Manchester United, this was undoubtedly a kind of a positive result. It does say a lot about Manchester United and where they're at, but you know, when you look at the stats and everything that Hamza just talked about there, this was a positive result for Manchester.
Do you think it's a one-off though, Gregor? I mean, I feel like in the last few weeks we've seen this from Liverpool a little bit. You know, we were all kind of thinking that Liverpool were this kind of chaotic, wild team, you know, maybe going to kind of go far in the title race, but do they have the kind of control? But actually, I mean, I was at the game against Palace the week before and they were really lucky in that match. You know, Palace were 1-0 up. Liverpool didn't really create anything. They looked so sort of listless and lacking in sort of tempo and direction. And they only really, you know, who knows what would have happened, but they only got the two late goals after Palace had a man sent off, you know, and thanks to a sort of Harvey Elliott long ranger in added time, you know. And there have been a few of those, right, against Fulham, Sheffield United, they would sort of scrape through. I mean, maybe this is the kind of, you know, champions team where they scrape through without playing well, but equally, I don't know. I'm not really seeing this kind of Liverpool that everyone's getting excited about recently. The forward, Darwin Nunez, hasn't scored now, what, in 9 or 10 games? Diaz, we haven't really seen the best of Diaz since the whole kidnapping thing. I just sort of wonder, when are we going to see Liverpool get out of kind of third gear, you know?
The thing is, about this season, we're seeing that about almost every team. Yeah. And they're still hardly sick in the league. So, you know, there are imperfections in every team in the title race, which is what is making us quite excited about it being a good title race. I absolutely agree. There have been a lot of kind of marginal victories, chaotic kind of victories as well, last minute goals, last minute equalisers, all that kind of thing. So it's not controlled. And the one team we're probably going to come and talk about who's starting to look a bit more controlled is Arsenal.
Yeah, well, we'll come on to them. I just want to give final word on Liverpool to you, Hamza. Thinking about some of the things that Thomas said there and looking at that team as well, because in the summer there was lots made about transfers not quite getting it right, but you've got Szoboszlai, Endo and Gravenbach in that midfield, and then as Tom says, you've got Nunez, who God loves a tryer but can't seem to score a goal. What do you think about the team at the minute? Is it a little bit short in areas? Is it just waiting to gel? Is it too many new players?
I think, as is true for most of the league, they've got a lot of injuries. So you look at McAllister was out, Thiago was... People forget about Thiago, right? But he's a really cool player. Jota's out. There's a number of... Matip's out as well. So there's a number of players that are missing, which affects the way that they play. Diaz, I think his bad form extends back to his knee injury. Since then, his production has dropped off massively. If Liverpool were to compete, I remember saying this at the start of the season, that they needed to have a sort of increase in production from Diaz of around like a quarter, and instead it's dropped off by around that same amount. So yeah, there's a few things going on there. They've got the system change, but even with all that stuff going on, if you look at, so in terms of our expected goal difference, they're still quite good, 0.88, which is pretty good. Ideally you want one. That's a measure of an elite team, and only one team is doing that this season. Over the past 10 matches, Arsenal, in terms of expected threat, so like if you sort of, so expected goal difference comes from all the sort of shots that you have, but it doesn't sort of take into account control. So if you sort of measured up every sort of player's ability to move the ball into dangerous areas, and that's how you get sort of expected threats. You have your threat for, threat against, subtract it, and it's like the best measure of control. And Arsenal at 1.11, incredible, over the past 10 matches. City's has dropped off, Liverpool's is 0.87, City's 0.7, so they aren't as controlled as Arsenal. But yeah, there's a few different things going on, and a few players have that form over the past 6 matches in particular. City have dropped off, Liverpool dropped off, and suddenly Arsenal have found a new gear, particularly sort of Martin Odegaard, and that's all knitted everything together very nicely over this period, where you, especially when you've got you've got such a concentrated number of matches in such a short amount of time. If you're playing well in this period, the points just rack up very, very quickly, and suddenly you're top of the league.
First appearance on the podcast, Hamza, and you're already linking us between sections, so we're into Arsenal already. Perfect stuff. They're top of the table, taking advantage of Liverpool dropping points. Tom, Hamza's already outlined kind of some of the things they're doing well. I wanted to ask you first about a piece you wrote for the Sunday Times all about Jorginho. It was headlined, "How Jorginho is Acting as Mikel Arteta's Eyes and Ears," and predominantly looked at his role kind of off the pitch rather than on it.
Yeah, we spoke to Jorginho. He calls himself Georgie. Jorginho on Friday.
I think I can call him Georgie.
Oh, gee. And it kind of came from the Villa game the week before, because Arteta was sort of banished to the stands because of his ban. And it was very noticeable that Jorginho was kind of on the line, you know, running up and down the technical box, instructing the players. He looked very much like an assistant manager, I guess. And we spoke to him on Friday when we were talking to him about this. And, you know, he sort of ticks a lot of the boxes, I guess, of the things we kind of expect of players who are going to be good managers. You know, he's a defensive midfielder, very kind of good on the ball, understands the game, speaks 4 or 5 different languages. He's won things, of course, you know, with the Champions League with Chelsea and the Euros with Italy. And there is this idea, you know, that he is sort of a conduit almost between the players and the coaching staff. And also, you know, this idea that Arsenal needed to bring in some kind of winning mentality, I guess, and to use that cliche, but also sort of experience and players like this, where it's not just about kind of technical ability and nice players like Odegaard and, you know, Reece Nelson, etc., but players like Declan Rice, who we've obviously talked about a lot, who on the pitch is kind of bringing that physicality, that sort of killer instinct, if you like. And I think off the pitch, Jorginho is providing a bit of that as well. Not playing very much, although will be being brought on, you know, for the sort of latter stages of games to add what we've talked about, that kind of control. But off the pitch, you know, very much the sort of brain box and eyes and ears of Arteta in the changing room.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you talk about that area of midfield with him, Declan Rice, and Hamza, to go back to your point about Martin Odegaard. Do you think he's a player that has, with the likes of Jorginho coming in and then Declan Rice, his game has gone up a level?
Definitely. Again, I'll come back to sort of six match sort of average. So, Odegaard, as everyone knows, wasn't playing as well at the start of the season. And that form didn't compare to how he played last season. But then in the past six matches, he's averaging sort of 3.2 key passes a match, five passes into final third, 3.3 passes into penalty area. So the issue Arsenal had at the start of the season with Odegaard was that he just wasn't involved very much. Now they've found how to do that. And that part of that comes through Rice. In fact, there's actually what Rice does, he opens up all sorts of tactical possibilities. And in the Brighton match, on Match of the Day, you can find this sort of like image, but the way Brighton play is, they, when they're building out from the back, the goalkeeper, they will leave four forwards forward. So they'll go man for man at the top of the pitch. So if you're the defending team, you also have to leave four players there. But if you want to press, you're going to have to send your forwards into their box, which leaves a massive space between the defensive line and the forward line. And that's what Brighton look to exploit. They ideally want to draw you in and then play into those spaces, and there's loads of space and then they can attack it. Arsenal had one man there, Declan Rice, and he was incredible. He had to cover this entire section of the pitch on his own and choose when to either move forward and join the rest of the press or when to drop off, and he had all of it sort of done perfectly. And that was the difference there. And him being able to get the ball in those situations and immediately feed it to Odegaard on the cusp of the final third meant that Odegaard was suddenly in far better attacking situations than he has been in the previous sort of like 10 matches, and then you could begin to see his influence a lot more. So yeah, Rice is a facilitator in more ways than many people realise, in that it allows Odegaard to be a bit further forward and get closer to Saka and Jesus and all those players.
Do you think Arsenal then, potentially for Arsenal fans, it's exciting in the idea that they could be getting even better gradually and gradually as the season and as we hit this busy Christmas period as well?
Definitely. I mean, you can look at the sort of stuff that we wrote at the start of the season, when it was clear Arsenal were defending very well, but the attacking fluency was absent. You look at the first match, I was at the Forest match and I was at the Fulham match, and it looked like the players didn't know what they were doing up front. They looked quite sort of dazed and sort of over-encumbered with information. And that was true for a number of matches where, again, this wasn't any sort of attacking fluency. Arsenal had this tendency to play in a sort of horseshoe around the back, play to the wings, and then try and progress up the field that way. They still do that in a similar sort of way, but instead of just playing to the horseshoe, now they're involving their centre midfielders, and Havertz has come into his own a little bit after looking like a complete sort of ghost for the first sort of eight matches, I think that's probably fair to say. And Odegaard has found himself a bit more as well. So yes, the key point was that Arsenal were pushing top of the league, moving top, without even playing well. And now in the past six matches, you take the first half against Wolves and other games like that, you see real attacking fluency, real cohesion. You take the Lens match, Champions League in particular, where they're actually allowed to play in transition. You go, wow, there's a brilliant attacking team there that we saw last season and we hadn't really seen between April to November.
Hmm.
And now they're back again, but with that amazing defensive performance that is by far the best in the league. Set piece suppression, open play suppression. Arsenal are excellent, top to bottom.
Great. Let's see if Gregor agrees with you, because I was going to ask about Arsenal, but also about City, because it's the team that you always come back to and say, oh, they're going to win the league. They drop points again, 2-2 at home to Crystal Palace. Kind of asking you about Arsenal and City then, because looking at both of them at the minute, there's only one team that looked like a kind of title favourites, and it's not Manchester City.
Yeah, it's like a team that has found that sense of control about their play, and a team in City who are still desperately trying to find it. I'm glad Hamza said at the end that the kind of result of that for Arsenal is the best defence in the league, because, you know, you can't overstate how important that is. And that's, you know, in this game it was because of the way they kind of strangled Brighton, and you know, Brighton normally have 62% possession, I think, on average, and in this game it was like 51, which is a massive drop off. And De Zerbi said afterwards, like, we're used to controlling the game. That was my most disappointing thing from this, is that we didn't control the game. So to do that to Brighton is no mean feat. City, I don't know. I'm finding it harder, you know, as we're doing a Q&A for the site today, picking a winner. I'm finding it harder and harder to stick with City, but I am sticking with them.
I know. Well, I'm going to keep pushing you until you flip flop and change your mind.
Well, because this is the lowest, so we know this is now the lowest number of points that Guardiola's team has won at this stage of the season for Manchester City. Only one fewer than one season when they won the league, I should point out, which was 2020-21. And there's also a kind of important stat, which was important in this game as well, is that they've now dropped 9 points from conceding 5 goals after the 80th minute. That puts them top of the league.
Mm.
And it's not easy to say, right, we'll cut them out. But there is something about, again, it's the kind of control thing, about not being able to kind of see out games in the way that they used to just knock the ball around and like see out games with ease. And there have been sort of individual errors. Diaz kind of running back with Schlupp, I think it was, in the build up to the first goal. Foden gave it away really, really poorly in the build up to the second, then gave away the penalty. These are things that would have Guardiola tearing his hair out if he had any. So, like, I still think that in the grand, you know, the grand scheme of things, looking at the overall picture, there's a lot of improvements still to come from City. So I still think they'll win the league.
Interesting. As you mentioned there, Greg, this piece, you can read the Q&A with our football writers. It will be on the Times website probably by the time you're listening to this podcast, so check it out. But one of the answers and questions that I can give you an exclusive insight to is who will win the Premier League. And Tom, will not you pick Arsenal?
I did pick Arsenal, yeah. I think, I don't know, I wasn't questioned on it at the start of the season, so I don't know if I'm being consistent or not, but in my mind, I feel like I was picking Arsenal at the start of the season, but that might just be...
Don't ask us every week. Listen, anyway.
don't worry about consistency, I'm just talking about your answer today, and a kind of as a summary, if you like, about the guy's points about Arsenal.
I'm just impressed with the control. I think that is a big factor. I also just think they've got this real tunnel vision this year. I know they got the Champions League and they're playing well there as well, and that will come in February, March again. But I just get the sense around Arsenal that they really are focusing on the league and they feel very ready to be champions this year. I think last year it almost happened a little bit earlier than everyone thought, and they were like, you know, blimey, we're top of the table. What do we? How do we handle this? You know, and we all saw the kind of collapse. This year I feel like they're ready to kind of take the next step. It reminds me a little bit of, you know, other sport, but remember how Novak Djokovic, you know, lost a series of Grand Slam finals before eventually winning one, and Andy Murray as well. And I think sometimes in these things you have to go through that kind of failure mentally to sort of understand what needs to be done next time. And that's the vibe I get about Arsenal this year. Very focused, very ruthless. The one game that sort of worried me a little bit was that Luton game, in fact, you know, when they won 4-3 in the last minute. I thought, well, that was a bit more kind of like the old Arsenal last season, very emotional, kind of chaotic last minute winners, etc. But in general, they just look almost slightly sort of predictable, almost slightly boring, you know. And when we're talking about Liverpool and City and everything is so kind of scatty, and it's that kind of trudge of win, 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 2-0, 1-0, these kind of things that I think really makes them shine out at the moment.
An absolutely massive game on Saturday, of course. Liverpool hosting Arsenal, probably the fixture of the season so far, potentially. But can't not talk about the top of the table without mentioning Aston Villa, because they're still there. 38 points, only one behind the leaders, Arsenal. And it was another thrilling win for them. Gregor, you were there at Brentford. Did it feel like a, you know, I found it interesting when they equalised, for example, straight get the ball back to the centre circle. You know, it looked like a team that's like, we need to win every single game. We want to win the title.
Yeah, I mean, it was a weird game, because up and it turned into like utter madness in the last 20 minutes from Ben Mee sending off, which did tilt the game in their favour. Because up until that point,
correct decision for you, just quick.
Yeah.
Continue.
Up until that point, they had created chances in the first half, but it was really fascinating in the first half. I was telling Hamza this earlier. There were periods in the first half in particular where the only player not in Brentford's defensive third was Emi Martinez, the goalkeeper. So even the centre halves were like fully involved in trying to press and probe through and break down Brentford, who were also absolutely happy to sit and defend their box and try and, when they win the ball, turn it over to exploit Villa's high line. So it was a really fascinating kind of tactical tussle. But Villa could have scored three or four in the first half. Then Brentford scored before half time and had something to hold on to. So, like, until the sending off, I was watching the game thinking, I think Brentford could see this out. Mm. And I think there's every chance they would have. So it did take a bit of fortune, but what they did was they really kind of went for the jugular once Ben Mee had gone off. And I know it's a cliche, but it's kind of, they ground out a really gritty win at a place that everyone hates going to. Even though Brentford were injury ravaged, the way that they set up to play in that kind of like 5-3-2, like, so hard to break down. And Emery said that afterwards. He's like, I knew that this was going to be a really, really difficult place to come and get a win. And despite all the chaos, despite Emi Martinez's antics and all this, which were hilarious, he was just absolutely delighted to leave with 3 points.
Do you think, very quickly on Ben Mee and decisions, he should have had a penalty in the first half with John McGinn's grappling?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that is perplexing is kind of that when VAR doesn't intervene, and we've seen this a few things in this weekend, that was definitely a penalty. The one with Mopai, I think Mopai went through again after Ben Mee had been sent off, but before Villa equalised, so it would have made it 2-0. Mopai went clean through, and he tried to buy the penalty. He stepped across Konsa and went over. But you've seen them given.
Mm.
So you could see why Thomas Frank was pretty upset by this.
Yeah, Brentford can feel a little bit hard done by. Hamza, on Villa, they're a team that you've written about lots with James Gearbrand in the football newsletter, and also in your piece looking at trends across football in the country. What is it you think they've got? Is it all about Unai Emery, or is it about these players?
A bit of both. There's some form that's... I mean, if you take a look at Ollie Watkins and Emi Martinez in particular... Watkins is historically quite a streaky player, and at the start of last season he had this like historically bad performance level for him, as in, so he had lots of XG but was undershooting it by a significant amount. And Emery comes in and tweaks his position very slightly, so what Steven Gerrard asked him to do was to contribute in midfield and support the build up, and Emery told him essentially, no, I'd like you to actually play as a more conventional centre forward, and rather than trying to come in deep, why don't you to run in behind? And that very slight change meant that the quality of chances that Watkins was now getting on the end of increased, and it reduced the sort of responsibilities on him to try and link play, just let him focus on being a finisher. And then with Emi Martinez, if you look at the expected goals he was meant to concede and the goals that he did, he was really performing very badly until the World Cup. And then he had an excellent World Cup and returned to English shores with the feeling of a world champion. And since then, his form has been incredible. And he's been brilliant. And then you've got other stories. Boubacar Kamara was injured last season for quite a long time. Brilliant. He's excellent. Douglas Luiz, excellent as well. These players that now have been sort of enmeshed and had a bit more time to get to know each other. So the few tactical tweaks that Emery's done, and I think what he has... He's put a bit more emphasis in Johnny's piece with Emery. The interview around a month ago, he mentioned Emery's first sort of sentence to the players was, "I'm not happy." Do you want to know why I'm not happy? And they also went, "Is it because we're near the relegation zone?" He went, "No, because a manager's been sacked, and that's on you." And that sort of that intensity and that sort of elite sort of mentality, for want of a better phrase, is precisely what Emery has bought, and I think that's why coming in together and tapping into all those other things, why Villa are playing well at the moment.
Yeah, it's exciting times for Aston Villa, but you mentioned him there twice. We have to talk about Emi Martinez. Now, as a fan of a team in the Football League, I'm a huge fan of, I'm going to say it, shithousery. I'm an absolute massive fan of it. I think it's brilliant, and I think it's a much needed aspect of this game. I would say,
really?
I would say that Emi Martinez, however, is treading a fine line between shithouse and arsehole, because I don't know how he can keep pushing it. What I mean, Tom, it's a subject that you have written about before this game. Emi Martinez, one of the most hated players, but so loved they named a frog after him. And I mean, it is becoming... as much, probably more so, you know, Hamza's outlining what a good footballer he is, but this is becoming the dominant narrative around him as a player, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there are certain players that kind of generate this extremity of opinion, you know. I mean, I sort of think about Sergio Ramos comes to mind. I think Luis Suarez was a bit like this, wasn't he, when he was in the Premier League? And I think Emi Martinez is probably now the kind of number one in the world for this sort of thing. Where, you know, Argentina fans and Villa fans absolutely love him. You know, he is an absolute legend, brilliant goalkeeper, etc. You said, I mean, in Argentina, after they won the World Cup, they named this sort of ancient South American horn frog Dibu Martinez after him. You know, that would just not happen right anywhere else. But for every other team, you know, he's a complete pain in the arse, basically. But I think he's a fascinating character because, in a way, this sort of partnership with Emery is really interesting, because Emery is like the biggest kind of football nerd, if you like, you know, very straight, quite cold emotionally almost, you know, very methodical. And yet somehow they've found this kind of common ground where they're both obsessed about the game, you know, very kind of passionate, will to win, I guess, is where the kind of the common ground is between them. And it goes right back to when they were at Arsenal together, and Emery kind of, you know, said to Martinez, for example, when, you know, he sent him out on loan and he had two offers to go to the Leeds at the time, who were kind of gunning for promotion, and Reading, who were basically trying to survive. And Emery said to him, look, I want you to go to Reading because you've had it too easy. I want to see you in the heat of the battle where, you know, in a difficult situation where you're going to have to make a lot of saves. And so Martinez went to Reading, and he said basically that his time at Reading was really formative for him, because he basically realised that, he didn't call it arrogance, but he said it's not the arrogance about thinking you're the best goalkeeper in the world, it's having the arrogance that you can have the confidence to show it, almost like putting on a persona on the pitch that gives others kind of confidence, gives you confidence. It's almost like an act, right, that you kind of pretend like you're the dog's bollocks, and then you become it. And that is kind of what Martinez does, I think. You know, I think it is almost an act. You know, you talk to people behind the scenes about Martinez, you know, and he's family man, three dogs, two kids. He launched like a lovely institute back in his hometown in Argentina for like struggling teenagers. When he goes back there, he's like a, you know, very nice, kind of calm kind of guy. But on the pitch, he's a pain in the ass, you know, and that is kind of part of the package, you know. And I think, in a way, you know, he's one of the leaders in the dressing room. Emery loves him, and the Villa fans love him because of that. You know, he generates this kind of feel and atmosphere around the game. And also, just to finish the point, he's a really good goalkeeper. Like, you look at the stats, and this is kind of the point for him, I think, is the shame, is that maybe it slightly takes away from his performances, because ultimately, when you think about Martinez and Argentina in the World Cup last year, what do you think? You think about the image of him holding the trophy over his crotch. You think about the celebrations with Mbappe holding the doll, etc., etc. You forget that it was his save against Colomwani, which basically won Argentina the World Cup. You know, forget Messi and everything. If it wasn't for that save, France are world champions. And in a way, that World Cup Argentina win should be remembered just as much for Martinez as it is for Messi. But it's not, because of all this extra stuff. So in a way, I guess it's good for him, and also it's bad for him. Maybe if he was a slightly calmer character, we'd all be saying he's one of the best goalkeepers in the world.
But the reason I touch on the idea that it's maybe going a little too far, because I take your point, all those things are why, and as I said at the top, even as an opposition fan, the reason we hate these players is because actually secretly we want them on our team, because we know that if they were on our team, we would love them. But the reason I make the point about Martinez maybe taking it a little too far is the example of this match against Brentford, Gregor, where, you know, he kind of manufactures, along with Neil Mopay, another one fond of these kind of
antics. Yeah, lovely fella.
But he manufactures a situation where, and in the end, Kamara gets sent off for a straight red card. And I thought it was really interesting watching Don McGinn's reaction.
Yes.
Going, for God's sake, why have you done that?
Yeah.
You just, oh, crap, we've got a player sent off for the straight red card at a really important time.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it sparked some pretty heated scenes. I mean, it was hilarious too, because when he was trying to haul up Neil Mopay was like some kind of dummy, like just kind of like completely limp and just like fell back onto the floor with his shirt over his head, didn't move at any point. It was just like pantomime stuff, but you're absolutely right. It's created a kind of, Emery ran onto the pitch to try and contain his players. He was booked. There was a dozen bookings in the second half, but there was a lot after that incident as well. And as you say, Kamara was sent off, and he'll be suspended and missing for the next game now, because he went just too far. He grabbed an opponent by the face, and they're always going to go off after that. So, did they gain anything from it? That's ultimately what you're asking at the end of this. He made some really big saves. They gained a lot from that. I'm not sure they gained anything from him like having a little set to with Neil Mopai in the closing stages when they were already in front.
Very interesting indeed. Well, if you've got strong views on Emi Martinez's behaviour, or maybe you just want to tell us something that we've missed in recent weeks, you can get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. Up next, we're taking a look at the teams at the bottom of the table.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark, and I'm joined today by Hamza Khalik Lunat, Tom Allnut, and Gregor Robertson. Now, chaps, before we get back to the football, I wanted to briefly mention Tom Lockyer, the Luton Town captain who collapsed during their match at Bournemouth. I wanted to discuss it not to speculate on what might happen, but because, Tom, you interviewed Lockyer during the summer, and he talked very openly about the first time that this kind of thing had happened to him in the playoff final last summer, which was obviously another very traumatic event. Tell us a little bit about that interview and the kind of player that you encountered and met that day.
Yeah, it was a really enjoyable interview, actually. Tom Lockyer is a really open guy, and you can really tell that he's one of those players who's come from low down the leagues. You know, from a sort of journalistic point of view, he didn't have that kind of pizzazz and glamour, and so, you know, he was very open and relaxed. We sat at the training ground at Luton, and the planes going over as normal, and he was talking through his long career and how he almost kind of gave it up when he called his mum to come meet him in Nando's one day, and he basically said, "Mum, I've had enough, like I'm not getting in the team." I think this was the Bristol Rovers, which was his first club, and I think is sort of the club of his heart, really. And he very nearly kind of gave up the game, and his mum was very much like, "Oh, you know, you got to keep going, you know." No, his mum, sorry, was like, "Okay, like maybe you should go and do something else." I've always thought this sort of thing. He went home or whatever, and his dad was sort of on the phone and said, "What are you having your mum said? Get back on the training pitch, get back into it." So that's how he kind of carried on his career. Really nice guy, good defender. I mean, you know, he talked about what happened in the playoff final, and you could tell that it was still very much kind of at the forefront of his mind. It wasn't something that he kind of had pushed away. He said he found it quite difficult still to talk about it, that his mum couldn't even look at any of his kind of playoff memorabilia. You know, I think he probably has the shirt hanging up in his room or something, and he said that she can't even really look at it, or even, you know, go over the photos of the final. And he admitted that he found it quite difficult to kind of come to terms with him missing out on that moment. You know, he admitted he felt a bit of resentment towards the whole thing for a few weeks afterwards. But obviously, at the beginning of the season, just huge enthusiasm to be back in the Premier League. And, you know, talking about facing Erling Haaland and all this kind of thing. I mean, I guess, you know, obviously we wish him all the best. And we wait to see kind of what happens from here. I mean, he was talking about how he was treated by the same doctor as Christian Eriksen. It's Dr. Sharma, I think it is. And obviously it's a problem they have to fix, right? Because, I mean, who knows if he's going to come back and play in the game again. But, I mean, yeah, we wish him all the best.
Absolutely, we do wish him well. It's an incredibly difficult time, but obviously a very strong character, as you could tell from that interview. We've got to move on, and we're going to talk about some more football again now. And Hamza, you were at West Ham, and I was excited about this. I thought Moisey's done it again. Mohamed Kudus, got lots to be excited about. And yet in the preparing for this show, you were like, nah, not so fussed.
Yeah, it was a quite even game, actually. I know they won 3-0, but the actual game was pretty sort of even, chances for both teams. The only difference was that West Ham were clinical, and the reason they were clinical was because they've got Kudus and Paqueta and Bowen, some really, really cool attacking players. And I included Alvarez in those three as a sort of fabulous technical foursome, because they're brilliant and they understand each other really well. So later on in the game, Paqueta moved to the number nine position and he interchanged with Bowen really nicely, set him up for the third goal. You see throughout the match and across matches this season, Paqueta has swapped with Alvarez, so Alvarez will advance forward and press, and Paqueta will drop deep to instigate play. Yeah, there's some really, really cool players there that that you just wish you could see a bit more of. But at the same time, I guess we are seeing more of Kudus. He's an excellent signing, and I think I read somewhere today that Erik ten Hag will be looking at Kudus and going, I probably signed the wrong Ajax player. Because he's performing far, far better than Anthony is, and he looked a real prospect. The only issue is that he's going to go away for the African Cup of Nations. Likewise, Benrahma might, if he's back in time. Agüero will go, and I think Maxwell Cornell might as well if he's back from his injury.
Yeah, that'd be a big blow for West Ham. Just talking again about that attacking lineup. Obviously, West Ham have had problems with a striker, a traditional striker, and lots of people have talked about, oh, this is the only thing missing. Obviously, they tried and kind of failed with Scamacca. Mikel Antonio has worked incredibly hard in that role for a long time. Do you actually think that with the players you've outlined there, that actually they're better with a bit of a kind of roving, free-form forward line?
Well, as in, from a personal point of view, I prefer watching that. David Moyes has a very specific sort of profile of what he wants from a centre-forward, though. And Mikel Antonio did fit that. But if you look at his stats this season, I think he had like 9 shots at one point after like 10 games. It was like really bad. It looked like his legs had gone, and he was really struggling for form. Divine Obama's a really good player as well, but I just don't get the sense at the moment that, David Moyes historically has not been one to put in young players up front because of that profile. He wants players that can hold the ball up, run the channels, be a bit more sort of robust. But at the same time, when we spoke about Paqueta yesterday, it's on Sunday if you're listening later on in the week, he mentioned that usually he doesn't give players a lot of leeway, and it's very important to him that he doesn't give anyone leeway. But he looked at Paqueta and went, actually, I'm going to make an exception for you. You're so good, you're excellent, and with such talent like that, you need to allow it to flourish and breathe. But yeah, I think that sort of more fluid attacking line is better, personally. But I think David Moyes sees it a different way, so you might not get to see that so much if you're a West Ham fan.
Tom, it's something that I've asked Gregor a lot, so I'm going to come to you instead, because he's covered a lot of West Ham over the last kind of year or so. They're a strange team in lots of ways. Drawing with Crystal Palace in what was widely considered one of the more boring games of the season, then beating Tottenham, then getting smashed by Fulham, and now beating Wolves, all while progressing in Europe as well. I mean, what are West Ham? They're eighth in the table at the minute. Is that about where they are? And actually, should they be really happy with that?
Yeah, I have no idea really what West Ham are. I think they're sort of like, they were sort of trying to play more attacking football this season. Initially, in the first few months, we kind of saw a bit of that. But I think there's been signs, and maybe Hamza will know this better than me, in the last few weeks, they're kind of going back a little bit to the sort of more traditional Moyes model. I have a problem with Bowen playing down the middle. I think he just doesn't look as threatening there. He looks slightly uncomfortable. I mean, I think he's probably West Ham's best option there, but maybe that's not the best option for him, because I think Bowen's real threat is when he arrives late, you know, when he's coming at the back post and coming from deep, whereas when he's playing centre forward, I think he just takes the edge off him a bit, although he is extremely good in the air. So they do have a bit of a problem there. If they could get a more sort of traditional centre forward, if you like, and get Bowen back out wide, or maybe this rotation thing offers a solution, then maybe that will get the best out of Bowen again. I think, you know, ultimately, Moyes knows what he's doing. I don't see them ever getting pulled into the kind of bottom three or four or five teams this season. And why not? Why can't they have another good European run? You know, I mean, I think we get so kind of wound up with who's going to finish in the top four and who's going to nick the sort of seventh place, etc., etc. But why can't West Ham be a team that, okay, in the Premier League, they sort of win one week, lose another, but actually in Europe, in the Cups, they really go for it. And, you know, it was West Ham would tell you that last season was one of the best seasons in their history. And and I don't see why they can't make that a model to lean on going forward.
Yeah, well, going for it in the Cups is interesting, isn't it? Because they've got Liverpool in the quarterfinals of the EFL Cup, and then they play Manchester United and Arsenal. But, Gregor, you jumped there. Sorry, I interrupted.
I was just going to say that the conflict is still there.
Mm.
Like, within the fan base, within sort of... You know, that week, that last week that we just had kind of summed them up. You know, they as you say, they beat Spurs, they were hammered by Fulham. Then I was at the game where they completely wiped the floor with Freiburg, like really controlled 2-0, it should have been more probably. And after the game, Moyes was asked, you know, you're still your contract's up in the summer. Mm. Like, this is getting quite close, and the club was ninth at that point. As he said, they're in a quarter final, just gone through for the third consecutive year in Europe. Like, what's going on? And he's like, I'm completely comfortable with it. And then he was asked, well, what about the players? And he said, that's different. The players won't, you know, there's a lot of new players here. They might want to know a bit of certainty about where the club's going. So for me, I think, like, the evolution, he keeps using that word as well. He said, we want to see the way we play evolve. And he has to do that for him to be West Ham's long-term manager. Like, they might, if they, you know, were to finish sixth or seventh or something this year, get to the final of the Europa League, whatever, it'd be mad, you know, it'd be madness for him not to get a new contract. But I wouldn't imagine it'd be like a long-term contract. And maybe there's another year, we'll see how we're going. It's like a taking over thing. If he wants to be there long-term, he has to evolve the way that West Ham play. And that doesn't mean just being reactive, but having quality players like Paqueta and Kudus who are really clinical on the break. That means being a team who are like the main protagonists in most game, and that's a massive divergence from David Moyes of old. So, yeah, I think he must know that. I think he must know that results alone will do something for him. It'll keep him in the job. It'll keep enough people happy. It'll keep the club happy. But he must know that he's not going to get enough results to win a trophy every year. He's not going to get enough results to probably to get in the Champions League or anything like that. So he needs something else. Yeah, that's the eternal conflict at the heart of West Ham, isn't it?
It always comes back to David Moyes, doesn't it? And Martin Samuel's written his Monday 8 a.m. online column about that topic. Next season will be tough, he says. It's the wrong time for West Ham to lose David Moyes. So,
but there's no like firm committal to David Moyes is the right man.
No, but
in
exactly,
that column.
So that's what's the interesting point, isn't it? And that's, as you say, that's the crux of the argument. There's no buying in, but that's the fascinating thing, isn't it? Even Moyes himself has kind of accepted this as the state of play, and he might even accept a 1-year contract. So just to finish, chaps, on the subject of West Ham, two questions. Will David Moyes be given a new contract at the end of the season? And should he be given a new contract at the end of the season? Greg?
God, they're almost impossible questions to answer, Tom.
That's why I asked them. Should he? Based on what you've seen, try to forget all the kind of West Ham.
I can honestly see the arguments for both, but if they continue in this vein and, you know, they're competing to get in European spots in the Premier League, if they're threatening to win a trophy, you know, a domestic trophy, if they're going deep in Europe again, I can't see how you can sack him. But I totally understand all the
so
feelings.
Yes, you think he should get.
I feel he should stay. Yeah, but I totally understand.
You don't think he will?
No, I think he might. I think he might.
You think he might?
I think he
Hamza.
I think, to be honest, my guess is as good as any listener's, whether he will or will not.
I know, but that's the fun of it. You're here, they're not.
Truthfully, I don't know whether he will. I also think there's a sort of fascination and sort of fetishization of a certain style of play that we have nowadays. Everyone wants to play nice football. But I think actually that's not always desirable. I think if everyone plays the same style of football, or yeah, we press, or we all play out from the back, I think that's quite boring actually. And I think it's better to have a diversity of footballing styles, even if some aren't pretty. But I can say this as someone who doesn't support West Ham, obviously. I also know that David Moyes is someone that absolutely hates people talking about his future, and I completely respect that as well, because it is obviously awful to hear some idiot who writes in a newspaper saying, well, actually, I don't have like...
Are you talking about yourself there, or Martin Samuel?
About myself. So, look at this guy who doesn't have a UEFA Pro licence and has never coached like a professional team, trying to tell me...
You don't have a UEFA Pro licence. What? You don't have... I don't know what you are, otherwise. Out!
But yeah, I can understand that sort of. It's not very nice to talk about people. So on that side, at least, I would like him to stay because, first of all, I think it's important to have a diversity of tactical ideas. Second of all, I think that he has earned it, given the European performances. And I'd also think that when he talks about evolution, he would actually benefit from knowing if he's going to stay or not. As in, you can give him the opportunity to try and evolve his game, but as in, you can't try and do that midway through the season and go, actually, well, if it doesn't work, we might go out of Europe, we might finish poorly in the league, and then the club are going to think, oh, yeah. So you need certainty on that front. So I'd rather that he get the opportunity to stay on. But I would like him to give an opportunity to Divine Mbama. He's a good young player. but yeah, maybe Moyes will evolve on that side.
Lots of dancing around the subject. We've turned into a politics podcast. Tom, give us a definitive answer. Will he be there and should he?
I think he won't be because I think he only stayed really last season because of how they finished, and that's how often these things happen. You know, it's not about long-term strategy, it's about the last five games and the kind of the vibes, you know, and obviously the vibes from West Ham at the end of last season were great, and it will just depend on whether they happen to finish well this season or not. Should he? I take Kanza's point about diversity. I guess the thing is that if you are the fans who are having to kind of put up with the diversity every week, then it's a slightly different thing, you know, like if everyone else, you know, looking generally, it's lovely to have different styles. I agree with that. But if you're the side, if you're the fans have to kind of watch long ball football every week, which actually, to be fair, is not really what Moyes is, but then it's a slightly different thing. I mean, I just sort of briefly, I mean, I think there is a thing here for a few clubs in the Premier League that are like this. I mean, Palace are like this as well. You know, it's the conflict between having a manager that you think is going to keep you in the division, you know, where survival is basically the strategy every season, and you collect the TV money and you just exist in the Premier League. And that, for a lot of clubs in the league right now, is kind of success because they're never going to break into that kind of top four, top six, and they're probably not going to get relegated. So the owners think, well, why roll the dice? You know, why do you roll the dice on a Andoni Iraola or something, or a Patrick Vieira, or, you know, and you risk, yes, you might get great football and you might even kind of sneak into the top eight. But the risk that, you know, the stakes are so high, the risk is so much higher, you might get dragged into a relegation fight, you know. So you have these clubs in the middle who are basically just kind of happy to keep going and hope for the best in the cups, and that's kind of where West Ham are. And I would think maybe their fans might want something a little bit more. It's all about trajectory. Football is all about trajectory, and I think the fans might want something a little bit more exciting, a bit more ambitious.
Clubs in the middle, fans wanting a little bit more, not sure about identity. Honestly, you lads are teeing me up perfectly from section to section here, because we finished talking about Nottingham Forest and Everton and the idea that this Premier League season, with the new teams that have come up struggling, I wanted to touch on the idea that, you know, this really is a season for teams, not necessarily West Ham because they're performing at the higher end of the table, but teams like Everton, Forest, Palace and others, to kind of solidify, work out what they are, and be safe in the knowledge that they're going to stay up. And obviously these are two very different teams, Everton particularly because they've had that points deduction, and Forest on a terrible run. But I wanted to start with Everton. I mean, it's an absolutely extraordinary run. 1-0 against Forest, 3-0 against Newcastle, 2-0 against Chelsea, 2-0 against Burnley. This is the most archetypal Sean Dyche thing I think I've ever seen in football, Gregor. He deserves huge credit, doesn't he, for what he's done?
Enormous, yeah. I mean, I was among everyone who was writing them off really at the start of the season because of...
And then when they get a points deduction on top of that.
Absolutely, yeah. So what he's formed out of the group of players at his disposal, as we said before, and kind of pushing Onana up behind Calvert-Lewin, you know, maximising the strength at set plays, getting the most out of so many players, McNeil in particular, who's kind of seems, he's, you know, I think Tony referenced in his column today, it's kind of, he's just that one player with a little bit of height and quality who can kind of, you know, score a wonder goal or put in the kind of delivery that will lead to a goal. You know, he's worked with him before as well, so he's just maximising everything at his disposal. And this was a kind of brilliant performance of Burnley. It was kind of, it really summed up everything about both teams. Like what Burnley are about, they're kind of, you know, so much possession, so much, you know, 62% I think it was in this game, so much of the ball without doing a great deal with it, and a really, really soft centre as well. And Everton knowing how to pick on those weaknesses and be ruthless about it, and then defend the lead. So I think, you know, we saw that really laid bare in this game.
Hamza, do you think you were talking with West Ham and David Moyes about a diversity of tactical ideas and tactical thinking? Greg has just outlined there that Burnley, under Vincent Kompany, are sticking rigidly with this plan and desire of the way they want to play. Are you, I guess, then, from the point of view of diversity, delighted to have the likes of Sean Dyche and Everton in the league just to offer us that something different?
Definitely. I think people sort of look at Dyche's football, or maybe even Thomas Frank's football at Brentford, and go, well, that's not for us. I think it's actually excellent football. It's really effective. It's understanding what your team is and playing to their strengths. If you look at how they, so if you look at other teams in the division and see how they sort of control the pitch, Everton literally only control, as in they have a majority of touches, it's more than 55%, in just their penalty area. Everywhere else, they let their opponents pretty much have it. Other teams as well, Nottingham Forest, Luton, Sheffield United, none of them defend anywhere near as well as Everton. It's about tweaking and understanding how to use these players in a particular way. If you look at how they press as well, they don't... actually, when we did the... when James Gibb read the newsletter and we're working on it, one thing he noticed, this was a few weeks ago, that Everton, top of the league for tackles, and also, I think, second or third in Europe. That, interestingly, is a complete inversion of Dyche's tactics at Burnley. So if you look at the 16-17 season, I think, or it might be the one before, it might be the one after, Burnley had the second fewest tackles in Europe. So you see this complete stylistic change, but still keeping those same principles.
Was that because Burnley were famed for defending the box and making lots of blocks, kind of last-ditch defending, rather than actually kind of being proactive in
So Everton do press and they also don't. It's interesting. They don't press all the way from the front, but what they do, they encourage teams into the middle third and then guide them with their 4-4-2 shape, push them to one side, and then they pounce. And that's why they make loads of tackles. That's why they have, I think, the third or second most tackles in the middle third, only beaten by Tottenham this season. So yes, absolutely. I think Dyche has done a fantastic job, and I think it's really important that you have these managers that provoke other managers to think in different ways. If everyone just played the same way, Manchester City and Arsenal would win every week because they're better at pressing and winning the ball and turning it over than everyone else and playing with possession. But these teams, Brentford, Everton, Luton, play in a completely different way, and they all play different ways to each other, to be fair to them. And the Premier League is much richer for it, and managers also are much richer for it. They learn from these experiences, and players learn from these experiences. I think Everton are excellent. And if you look at their expected goal difference, I haven't checked today, but we did a piece on Saturday digitally looking at George Willoughby and I did. And Everton were ninth best in the league for expected goal difference. And the reason I bring that up is because Kevin Thelwell, the Everton director of football, he gave an interview a number of weeks ago, and he mentioned that the first five matches, Everton drew one, lost four. Everyone looked at the results and went, Everton are diabolical, they're rubbish, they're going to go down, Sean Dyche, yesterday's man, blah, blah, blah. But if you watch the matches, you look at them and go, how are they not winning? They had loads of chances, they just couldn't finish them off. And that has been the theme. As in, when you see that sort of level of performance, and Kevin said that he looked at the expected goal difference, went, actually, there's a really good underlying sort of performance level here, results will turn. And inevitably, they have, and they've improved. I think... they're really good, and I think they should be finishing top half, even with points deduction.
High praise indeed. I wanted to bring up some of those points and relate them to Nottingham Forest now. 2 points behind Everton in the table, only 5 points above Luton, and Luton have got a game in hand. What is the problem with Forest? Is it the off-field doubts? Steve Cooper still in charge? For how long? Who knows? Tom... This is a missed opportunity for Forest, isn't it? In kind of the guise of what I was saying earlier around the three teams coming up being a bit inexperienced and struggling, this was a missed chance for them to kind of solidify their status in the Premier League.
Yeah, give them a 10
point. It's not over yet, though.
It's not over yet, but I'm saying at this point in the season, we're in December, and you know,
they're not in a good place.
Doubts about the manager, in light of what Hamza was saying about a kind of Everton looking like they're peaking rather than kind of tailing off, Forest look completely lost.
Yeah, I mean, I've always kind of thought that Forest wouldn't necessarily be in a better place without Steve Cooper. Particularly mid-season, I tend to think that if they sacked Steve Cooper, that suddenly I would think of them as possibly in the mix for relegation. Whereas right now, I don't. Like, and maybe that's me just kind of being overly loyal to Cooper. I don't know, because of what he's done. But I think mid-season, if they rolled the dice here, then maybe, you know, I mean, if they were going to do it, they should have done it in the summer. You know, I just think now in the middle of the season, with all the players they have, I don't see that being a good solution for them. I don't know. I mean, I think Forest, I think they'll be okay. This is a bad run, and teams go through bad runs. You know, I mean, in the bottom half of the table, you have to accept that sometimes teams go through bad runs. This is a bad one. But I think they're going to be fine.
Well, yeah, Gregor, you jumped in there and said it's not over yet. And you're quite right. I'm being very exaggerative, as always, as a host of a podcast. I have to try and get some views out of you. But it's a slightly worrying time for Forest, even in the light of these teams below them who you think, oh, we'll be fine, we'll be fine.
Yeah, I mean, look, the last, it's a lengthy run, I think. What is it, 1-11 or 12? 1-1, something like 11 or 12. It's the last six games. They've lost five of the last six. Before that, there was like four draws and a win in that bunch, and it wasn't a bad bunch of results actually. But since they lost to West Ham, in fact, that's been a kind of real turning point for them. And I absolutely would like to see, you know, I think Steve Cooper should keep his job, but it's starting to creep in where it gets to a point with a manager where it's almost of no return. You think, and you're also thinking of the future too. You're thinking, Evangelos Marinakis, the owner, has been itchy. He's been itching to make a change for a long, long time, and you just don't see a sort of synergy between Steve Cooper, this really calm, sort of, you know, really well respected and liked in the dressing room, you know, process driven manager, and this feisty, erratic owner who wants to win the league and he wants to do it yesterday, like, and you know he'll trample over anything and he possibly can to do that. There's just no compatibility there, and I don't think there ever will be. So, like, well, I still, the question is for Forest fans then, is what's best for now, I think, and it all depends on who would come in. You know, Julian Lopetegui is kind of waiting in the wings for whatever jobs come up now. He had a remarkable impact at Wolves. He's a great manager, and who knows, that might provoke something. I don't want that to happen. I'd love to see Marinakis learn from the error, you know, from his mistakes, but I think the chances of that happening are very slim. So Steve Cooper might survive, but I don't think there's any longevity in this union.
Saturday, home to Bournemouth, another huge game. I said Arsenal against Liverpool was the game of the weekend. Maybe that is the game of the weekend instead for Forest fans. Chaps, we'll have to leave it there. Gregor, Hamza and Tom, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you too for listening. As I said earlier, if you've got any strong views, whether it's on Emi Martinez, Steve Cooper, or maybe just want to praise Sean Dyche, or hey, even send us some Christmas wishes, you can get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. We'll be back for our final show before Christmas on Thursday. See you then.
Listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.